It's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Rick Gelting. He's going to be speaking to us on water and sanitation hygiene in Haiti, past, present, and future. Dr. Gelting is an environmental engineer with the U.S. Public Health Service and is based with Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, where he works on water, sanitation, and hygiene issues. He has done research and provided technical assistance on issues related to the sustainability and health impact of WASH interventions. He holds a PhD and a Master's in Science degrees in Environmental Engineering from Stanford University. He is a registered professional engineer, and he was recently named in 2013 the Federal Engineer of the Year. Dr. Gelting.
Thanks, Jordan, and good morning. Thank you for coming. We've heard about the cholera epidemic in Haiti and some efforts to control it. I'm going to talk more about the WASH situation in Haiti and how we arrived at the current situation and where do we go from here. Before I do that, I want to quickly summarize the current WASH situation. We've already seen some of these figures, so I'm just going to skip over this pretty quickly. But as other speakers have mentioned, the water and sanitation coverage in Haiti is lower than in the region. And this definitely contributed to the severity and rapid spread of the cholera epidemic in Haiti, since, as you probably know, the primary means of transmission for cholera is through consuming water contaminated with human waste. If we look at trends, even though Haiti is at a lower level, water coverage is trending upward, but sanitation, unfortunately, is heading in the other direction. Haiti is one of the few countries in the world where sanitation coverage has actually gone down since the WHO-UNICEF joint monitoring program began collecting data on these coverage levels in 1990. So if you look at this, one of the questions that arises is why is Haiti's infrastructure divergent from the rest of the region? And I'm just going to touch on that quickly. First of all, it's nothing new. As far back as 1900, in the literature, public health specialists have reported on poor water quality and the links to disease in Haiti. The lack of infrastructure in Haiti has deep historical roots. There has been a lack of resources for infrastructure for various reasons. From the beginning of Haiti's independence, Haiti was isolated by the international community. There was a lack of trade, and a lack of leading to a lack of resources for investment. Resources were also diverted to defense, again, because of Haiti's international isolation, and then also debt service. Haiti actually paid an indemnity to France, one of the few cases where the winner of a war paid the loser. More recently in history, resources were diverted by governments to maintain power and control, and also sometimes investment was limited because of instability. If we look at cholera in the Caribbean, there were three major waves documented in the 1800s. The first one was in the 1830s in Cuba, the 1850s largely throughout the Caribbean in various areas, including the three out of the four large islands, Jamaica, Cuba, and Puerto Rico, Haiti being the other, Hispaniola being the other large island, and then later on in 1860s and 1870s. The Caribbean islands that did not have reported cholera, and again, this is in the 1800s, so this is from secondary sources, but there was no reported cholera in these islands, including Haiti, and then several of the other islands, which are smaller, the Caymans, the Netherlands Antilles, St. Martin, St. Bartholomew, Montserrat, and possibly Martinique. So if you look at those islands, obviously Haiti stands out. It's the only large island with a dense population that didn't have reported cholera. Some of the factors that have been speculated on why this occurred include the lack of plantation slavery in Haiti. Obviously, after Haitian independence in 1804, there was no slavery in the country. Slavery did persist in the Caribbean until the 1880s in some islands, or till 1880 in some islands. So those conditions could have contributed to the spread of cholera. Again, we're looking back at incomplete sources in the record. But the lack of investment in infrastructure did persist, that I mentioned earlier, did persist in Haiti. Throughout throughout the 1900s for various reasons. But if we fast forward to the more recent past, in March of 2009, a new government entity was formed called DINEPA, the National Directorate for Water Supply and Sanitation, or for Potable Water and Sanitation. And they had a plan for the first 3 years of basically a water sector reform that was passed by the government of Haiti, created DINEPA, and it incorporated prior organizations that were dedicated to water issues, including the Port-au-Prince Water Authority and a separate entity that was responsible for the rest of the country. Most of the efforts, however, had been directed at urban areas with little attention to rural areas. And also, there was no institutional home for sanitation that was included in the mandate of DINEPA, which was another new thing. So they came up with a plan for the first 3 years, including institutional reform, improving operations of water systems, and stimulating investment. Well, you all know what happened. 9 months later, the earthquake hit. So we have a brand new organization here, all of a sudden dealing with a huge disaster, the first of two, actually. And this was a pretty major event, as you all know. There were hundreds of thousands of deaths and injuries, and over 1 million internally displaced persons in over 1,000 IDP settlements. I just want to give you an idea of the scope of this. The Boston metro area is about 4 million people. So think about a quarter of the population of Boston homeless. Or, where are you all from?
Baltimore,
D.C. So is everybody from the nation's capital? Well, South Carolina, I know it's in North Carolina, but that would be more than the population of Charlotte, or close to D.C., more than the population of Delaware, the whole state. So we're talking about a huge number of people. And this immediately shifted the focus of the WASH sector from reform to emergency response. DINEPA was part of, DINEPA and UNICEF were the co-leads of the WASH cluster, a structure put into place to basically lead the response to the earthquake. That response included water trucking to the IDP camps and point-of-use chlorination, distribution of point-of-use chlorination products and soap. This appeared to be, later on when cholera came, effective because there was less cholera in the IDP camps than in some of the surrounding areas. 10 months after the earthquake, the cholera outbreak happened. It was first detected. This has already been discussed. It spread to all 10 departments, including Port-au-Prince, by mid-November. So less than a month, it spread to all the entire island, the entire nation of Haiti. Now think about this again. If a brand new organization has a national mandate dealing with two huge disasters in less than a year, and in less than 2 years after it was first formed. The WASH response to the cholera outbreak consisted of a number of steps, including increased chlorination of drinking water supplies, both at the community and the household level. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. Rehabilitation of piped water systems where they existed, and then distribution of household water treatment products and soap where there was no piped water systems. And then also prevention and hygiene promotion. And the oral cholera vaccine campaign, as we've already heard about. I'm just going to give a couple examples of this, of the current work that's going on, that's been going on since the end of the earthquake. This is by no means comprehensive, but some of the things that we've been involved in along with other partners, including household water treatment and storage, and then working on rehabilitating and improving community water systems. The objective for scaling up household treatment is basically to support new products that are inexpensive and easy to dose. One thing that happened after the earthquake, and this happens in a lot of emergencies, but we had, in Haiti, a lot of organizations came in, which was good because there was a lot of need, but there wasn't consistency with the products that were distributed. There were four different dosages of chlorine tablets. There were several different liquid products. The directions were generally not in Creole. It was very confusing. And so you had all these different products, really took a lot of public health promotion to try to straighten out, you know, to get people to think about what they really should be using. So that's part of increasing access and awareness. And so another thing that's happened is in-country production of chlorine solution is happening now. That's been promoted by several organizations within Haiti, including CDC. Before the earthquake and cholera, there was chlorine solution being distributed, but it was being brought in from the outside. And then also scaling up partner programs on household treatment, communications, and social marketing. And then DNEPA is working on a national strategy to coordinate household treatment. And that's one of the things they're also working on is basically coming up with standards and guidelines for things like, this is one example of household treatment, and I'm going to touch briefly on that in a minute about coordinating the sector. Another example of some present work was creating a rural WASH workforce. The TPACs, or Potable Water and Sanitation Technicians for the Communes program, was created within DNEPA. The idea was to have two of these technicians per commune, per rural commune outside of the metropolitan Port-au-Prince area. And their responsibility is to assess, basically to work on assessing and helping to maintain and disinfect small water supplies. This program has been a collaboration among DNEPA, the Inter-American Development Bank, CDC, and the World Bank. And basically, there was no workforce that existed before this program for the rural areas. DNEPA hired, trained, and deployed 264 of these technicians in 2012 and 2013. They are starting to provide data from the rural areas now. We've had a very positive experience with DNEPA. I'd really like to stress that. And one of the examples is this program right here. If you think about how long most organizations would take to hire almost 300 employees brand new, train them, and deploy them, I know we couldn't do it in the time frame that DNEPA did. So I think this has been a real success story. I'd also like to recognize Gabriella Lockhart in the audience here, who was intimately involved in creating and implementing the training program for the TPACs. So if we move from the present to the future, this has already been mentioned by a couple of the speakers, the National Plan to Eliminate Cholera in Haiti, which was created by the government of Haiti. And I'm going to skip through this because it's already been mentioned. But there are four areas, including water and sanitation. There's a separate plan for the DR as well. The areas of emphasis in terms of WASH and the national plan are investment, coordinating the sector, and strengthening government capacity. And that includes not just technical capacity, but administrative, budgetary, and management capacity as well. One of the things, you know, that happens when you have a big disaster and a lot of money comes in is you don't necessarily have the absorptive capacity to spend all that money, at least immediately. Just wanted to mention also, I mentioned before coordination of the sector. This is one of the things that DNEPA is working on, developing standards and guidelines for the sector, developing an agreement with the different organizations working in the sector so there's some consistency about things like distribution of water treatment products, and they will move eventually towards regulating the sector as well. So to conclude, I just want to put a couple thoughts out there. First, the cost of improvement, as mentioned in the national plan, will be significant, but so will the benefits. If we look at the Latin America cholera outbreak in the 1990s, WASH investments, as Dr. Tapero mentioned, it contributed to cholera control. One example is in Mexico in the 1990s. WASH investments, as you can read there, led to a big increase in the number of municipalities providing potable water and a concurrent decrease in diarrheal diseases in children under five. So we know this works. The question is, how do we implement it? Another issue is that this does take time, especially for sanitation. This is a graph that shows the levels of sanitation in several different countries and how it's taken some time to implement these things. Just as an example of that, if you think about the long-term investment it takes, when you got up this morning here in Boston and turned on the water, does anybody know where that water came from? That's right. You must be from around here. It comes from the Quabbin Reservoir, almost 100 miles to the west in western Massachusetts. And Quabbin Reservoir is a very large reservoir. The water stays in the reservoir for a couple of years, and so there's some natural treatment process going on. The water requires minimal treatment, then it gets pumped all the way out here to Boston. That kind of infrastructure doesn't happen overnight. it takes a long-term process and a long-term investment. So in Haiti, there's been a history of underinvestment in WASH. It will take, as I mentioned, a long-term sustained effort to improve the situation. And the national plan outlines how we can achieve the benefits from that investment, including investing in the sector, coordinating the sector, and building capacity. So I know we're going to leave some time for questions here, and I'm going to stop there.
Thank you, Rick, and thanks to all our panelists. And now we'd be happy to entertain questions for the four panelists here, if there are any questions. So please don't be shy, sir.
Nobody mentioned where the cholera came from, and there were some talk that it was imported by UN workers from Nepal. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I think there's been a lot of circumstantial evidence and a lot of written publications looking at the epidemiology in the area, and certainly that is the most promoted source for the introduction of Vibrio cholera. Anyone else want to address that further? Otherwise, I'll go to the next question. Okay, next, sir.
Getting something done there. I appreciate these comments because it's very useful information to find out how can we fix cholera in Haiti. But I think it's important to address the source, and I think UN has acknowledged that it's played a role as a lawsuit regarding this, I think sponsored by students or actually faculty at Yale. They did a very big report on it. We are there's a group of us that are having, I want to announce this because I think it's an important compliment to what was presented here. There's a forum this evening presenting why we think APHA should take a little more of a stand on the UN's role and acknowledge that it played a role in compensating people and helping people after this outbreak. And we think it's important to address some of the more of the political aspects. It's going to be this evening at 7 o'clock. This paper talks about it. I just want to let people know about it because it talks a little bit more about what work can APHA do.
Okay, thank you. So there's an opportunity this evening to hear more about the reimbursement of those who suffered from cholera in Haiti over the last 3 years. And if you would like more information, I'm sure the gentleman would be happy to stand outside and tell you more about this evening's activities. I would be happy to entertain more questions, and it would help me if you could identify who on the panel you would like to ask your question to. I really do think that in addition to the introduction of toxigenic Vibrios to Haiti, there is a lot looking forward about trying to eliminate, and that was the focus of this symposium. So please, any more questions for our panelists? Yes, ma'am. Dr. Gelting, would you like to take the first question? I mean, I think it helps if we come up to the microphone. Is that right? Can you hear us or not? It's on and off. I'm really sorry. Just raise your hands if it stops working, and we'll hit it hard.
We'll have Jordan hit it hard. That's an excellent question. Sanitation is a huge challenge, and it's definitely an area of emphasis within the national plan. So part of that is coordinating the efforts of the different partners, and DNEPA is working on that as well. I think there is going to be more and more effort paid to sanitation because that's part, obviously, of the solution is dealing with the sanitation problem. The sanitation levels are especially low in the rural areas, but even in the urban areas, it's a big challenge. If you look at a place like Port-au-Prince, it's one of the largest cities in the world with no sewer system. The Inter-American Development Bank is developing a master sanitation plan for Port-au-Prince. So, I mean, that's one of the steps in the right direction. For a place like that that has high density development, there's definitely going to have to be some alternative solutions. Just hit the microphone, not me. decentralized systems in some areas, maybe cluster systems, looking at different types of alternatives, maybe composting latrines or other things. So I think part of it is identifying the alternatives that work in different areas. And then also one other item that we need to understand more about is the behavioral issue surrounding sanitation. I mean, not just in Haiti, but in other places, but, you know, what works, what do people use, and why?
I'm Judy Lewis, and I've worked in the Grand Anse area of Haiti for about 20 years now. It's an area that doesn't have any infrastructure, especially in the rural areas. What's the cost of thinking about doing this, and are there funds and likely sources of money to make it happen? Because I think that's another huge concern.
What did you say? Yeah, one other thing about sanitation is that there have been some major improvements in the metropolitan area of disposal. That there are now two disposal sites for septic waste from either chemical toilets that are pumped from the IDP camps or latrine emptying efforts. So there were no designated disposal sites. The waste was being disposed of at the landfill. That's no longer happening. So there has been some progress on that front. In terms of the costs for sanitation are high. If you look at like an example like Boston, every time you flush the toilet, it gets pumped through multiple pumping stations to Deer Island out in the harbor, where it gets treated to a pretty high level and then disposed of. So, as I said, there are some planning efforts going on. There are also efforts on the ground to improve sanitation in various places. Most of the funding for the WASH sector is coming through the Inter-American Development Bank and also the Spanish Cooperation for International Development. So there is some funding for these areas. And then again, part of the coalition that Dr. Anders talked about is to maintain awareness around these issues and the level of resources that are required.
I think we had a question also for Dr. Ivers, and then we'll go to the next question. Thank you.
So just to answer the question about the cholera vaccine itself, at the time that we started the campaign, and I still now, there's still a little uncertainty about the exact duration of efficacy. At the time we had the campaign, we had 3-year data follow-up on Shankol that suggested, and it's different for different age groups, less protective for children. It was around between 60% and 70% effective at 2 to 3 years. But again, there's tables breaking it down. Dr. Vicari showed a slide with a new paper that just came out about a month ago with the 5-year follow-up data for Shankol that looked to be around about the same 5 years later, which is superior to what we probably thought it would be. So that's encouraging. And the other caveat is that most of the studies have been done in places where cholera is endemic. And so whether or not Shankol was contributing to a booster to some natural immunity versus a population like Haiti that had largely, they were unexposed, but by the time the campaign happened, it was still 18 months into the epidemic, so there was some exposure already in the population. We have been doing some immunogenicity studies with colleagues at Mass General Hospital, looking at, amongst those who received the vaccine, we had about 150 volunteers who agreed to have their blood drawn in a different series, so hopefully we'll have some information about that, and maybe we can follow those people over time as well. I hope that answers.
Yeah, it's great, great, all the interest. Please keep the questions coming. We have 15 minutes left. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I feel free to Dr. Vicari or Dr. Ivers. I understand that the production of the vaccine is an issue, and also that we weren't sure about the efficacy because it's fairly new. If things change and we increase the amount of international amount of Shankol, would universal vaccination for Haiti be something you're talking about, especially with, like, if it is true that 10% of the
Dr. Vicari, do you want to take that?
It has been considered, definitely. But I've shown as well, you know, the amount of people living, the number of people living in Haiti. It's about 10 million people. So if you consider at least 5 years, you know, of protection, just by the amount of vaccine we will need to get to the 10 million, and then probably to repeat that over time, you know, it is really a very large endeavor. At the same time, there is a need of the vaccine somewhere else as well. I mean, the whole possible use of the vaccine in Africa, it's an important use as well. So I think, you know, we need to balance a little bit what is the availability around of the vaccine, but as well the different needs that you will have around the world. The other part is that vaccination is really one of the possible actions that you can use in Haiti. And I think, you know, what is really important is this concept that over time, you know, we can improve water and sanitation. Of course, you know, as you improve water and sanitation, the need of the vaccination will go down over time. So I really see a little bit of dynamic in that sense, you know, as if there is really a delay in terms of getting to a better sanitation and availability access to potable water, I think, you know, there is more need of vaccination. But so I think it is very difficult this moment to say, you know, what is the outlook of the vaccination over time. Definitely, I think, you know, something that we need to keep the eye on is this use as a routine vaccination. I think, you know, in the old discussion about the use of OCV vaccine in the last year, I think it is something that we are really lost focus on, because, you know, there is really the need of this vaccine being used in endemic countries, but it's not being considered. And I think, you know, we have put a lot of emphasis on the use in an epidemic situation, which certainly there might be a use as well, but we have not really discussed about the endemic use of the vaccine, especially in Southeast Asia, and I think, you know, it is really something that needs to be considered as well.
Yeah, please do. Thanks. We're good.
Thanks. I forgot to mention just the point of herd immunity. So I think one of the main reasons why the vaccine was really reconsidered in March 2010 as being something potentially useful in epidemic settings or even for more extended use in endemic settings was related to reanalysis of data from earlier studies that demonstrated that there is a significant herd immunity effect from the vaccine. So potentially vaccinating 50% or more of a community would contribute quite substantially to improved efficacy both in the vaccinated and in the unvaccinated people. So I think in terms of the potential strategies for Haiti, it may not be necessary to vaccinate all 10 million people. It's also certainly true that it's not all 10 million people that are equally susceptible to dying from cholera or even from significant morbidity. So I think the herd immunity issue, the targeted strategy to those most at risk, and also the question has been posed as to whether a single dose of vaccine might have efficacy and how good that might be. And so there are some studies, I believe, underway by the manufacturers of Shankol to look at single dose efficacy over time.
As a moderator's prerogative, I just want to invite Dr. Anders to the podium to address immunization coverage in general in Haiti. I think it goes without saying that, you know, you can entertain a question like universal vaccination with oral cholera vaccine because of all the hard work that PAHO, CDC, and others, and implementing partners as well, like GESCU and Partners of Health, have made progress in Haiti with the government's EPI, or Expanded Program for Immunizations, over the last 3 years. Dr. Anders, would you like to address some of that? And this certainly wouldn't be possible without those demonstration projects that Dr. Ivers highlighted for you.
So, fortunately, there have been resources mobilized to tackle pneumonia and diarrhea in Haiti with the two vaccines that we have available, the rotavirus vaccine and the pneumococcal vaccine. For years, those resources were denied because Haiti didn't meet certain coverage levels, but we struggled with that because if you can vaccinate 50% of your population, why would you prevent or deny them the benefit of the vaccine? So this year, they're rolling out the rotavirus vaccine, and next year will be the pneumococcal vaccine. Modeling studies show about 6,000 children die of rotavirus infection, and certainly that many from an invasive pneumococcal vaccine or pneumococcal disease. So these are life-saving vaccines that the government is now rolling out. Huge challenges has been highlighted in Dr. Ivers' presentation, but Haiti has eradicated polio, measles, rubella, and congenital rubella syndrome. So they can do it, and it will be a challenge to ensure the delivery of resources and the implementation is done well, because these vaccines need cold chain, they need attention to the logistics and lots of coordination among a huge number of partners working on the ground. Thank you.
Thank you. And those accomplishments in measles, rubella, and CRS, or congenital rubella syndrome, were made possible to the investments after the earthquake, not before the earthquake. So there's been a lot of hard work in many sectors going on in Haiti and public health, and the Ministry of Public Health has played a prominent role in coordinating the responses in health. Can we have some more questions? The woman in lavender in the back, please.
The acceptability appeared to be very high. Cholera outbreaks tend to focus the mind. Obviously, when you have that big of a, as Dr. Ivers mentioned, the scourge of cholera, people were really highly motivated to use to disinfect drinking water. So acceptability appeared to be very high, and field surveys in the Artibonite Valley also indicated that knowledge about cholera was quite high. There were some issues with dosing. Some of that, I think, was related to the confusion that I mentioned earlier about multiple products and what to use. We have seen some drop-offs as the cholera outbreak drops off. The same thing happened in Latin America in the 1990s. So there are issues with sustainability of household treatment. If you've ever had to do that, you can see why. I mean, being your own water utility takes a lot of effort and a lot of time that, you know, could possibly be invested in other endeavors as well.
Next question, the woman in green and then the gentleman in blue. So for those of you who couldn't hear her, the question is about the role of water filters in addition to or as an alternative to chlorination in the home.
Yeah, there has not been as widespread use of filters in Haiti. We have a current project right now to look at not only the use but the manufacture of filters in Haiti. So it's definitely an alternative that's being explored. One thing about use of disinfection products is you do get a residual disinfection effect, which you don't necessarily get with filters. So, you know, it may be something that could be used in combination, but there are efforts now underway to look at more widespread use of filters, because it given the right circumstances, it could potentially be a more sustainable solution if a filter lasts 5 years or whatever that for providing drinking water.
Gentleman in blue.
Yeah, hi. CDC. The question was raised of not being able to give the cholera vaccine with OPV, and as someone who's done multiple cancer trials 50 years ago, advocate for antigen, and would wonder what are the data, and then secondly, they ask you to do the trials to find out, particularly as you get the monovalent OPV, maybe you could actually give both vaccines.
So, to my knowledge, there is no data to suggest that there's actually an interaction between OPV and OCV, oral cholera vaccine, However, we were issued a manufacturer's letter that told us that it was not recommended for them to be administered together, and we were in a somewhat unique situation where we were extremely time-pressured. We were trying to get the campaign going. The rainy season was coming. We already had a significant delays, and so we were in a situation where we couldn't really argue with them in a controversial setting where there were some who were not totally behind, at the time, were not completely convinced of this campaign. So we really didn't want to step on any, we didn't want to make any mistakes. So we were really in a situation where we had to abide by the manufacturer's recommendation. I've spoken with folks from Shankol. As far as I'm aware, there's no actual data that it's not a good idea, but there's also no data that it's not a bad idea. So I think that those studies would be extremely helpful from a logistics standpoint. And also in thinking of including cholera vaccination as part of routine immunizations, it certainly would significantly change the logistics. But I agree with you, but we were a little bit stuck in terms of our campaign.
Okay, it's 11:59. I think we have time for one more question. The lady in white there. Okay, Louise will answer that. I think all of us have something to add to that, but we'll see if Louise can cover it for us.
Well, I was just going to say, ask the most challenging question about Haiti, you know, with 30 seconds left. But I think whether or not things are getting better in Haiti is really very difficult to summarize in a sentence or a conversation or even, you know, one supplement to a journal. I've lived in Haiti from 2003 until 2012, and there were certainly days where I thought nothing is getting better here. But the reality is that if you look at the long, I mean, again, my perspective, if you look at the long story, things for me in Port-au-Prince are way better than they were the day of the earthquake. There has been a substantial amount of rubble removed. Almost all of the rubble is removed. There were 1.2 million people living on the street. And now, yes, it's still 300,000. It's still not acceptable. But it's certainly better than it was a year ago. I mean, I think the problem with Haiti is just that even before the earthquake and before the cholera epidemic, it was such a challenging place to live if you're poor. And there's so much hardship to be seen every day on the street that it can be very difficult sometimes to see the positive stories. But I do think that even the story here that we've been talking about, which is the response to the cholera epidemic, does show progress. I mean, we have gotten the case fatality rates lower than they were at the beginning. Still, we don't want anyone to be dying of cholera. We don't want to have cholera cases at all. But these things are certainly going to take time, and they're going to take money. And so for us and for me, the issue is in relationship to cholera, for example, we know how to do it. We know what we're doing. We know what works. We know how to prevent it. We know how to treat it. And what we need is really a sustained interest from the public health community, from APHA, from everybody here, to help us all to continue to keep going. So I think the side of feeling as though things are never getting better is somehow just the hard part of Haiti. But if you look for it and if you look over time instead of just from day to day, I really do think that there are a lot of good stories and a lot of stories of progress.
Thank you, Louise. And I'll just close with one final comment on this same topic. You know, in March of 2011, there was a donors conference in Haiti, and $11 billion were pledged for post-earthquake reconstruction across multiple sectors, not just health, but, you know, energy grids, roads, agriculture, et cetera. About $6 billion, as far as at least the figures that I'm aware of now, actually honored their pledge, $6 billion of that pledge. So we're all public health professionals. We're all public health practitioners in some way or another, or we wouldn't be at this conference. And when you have the opportunity to you know, to say that one of the biggest things that can make a difference in Haiti is support of their national plan, the plan for the island of Hispaniola for the elimination of cholera. I think that is an idea that should resonate. It's a long-term plan. It's a long-term commitment, as all of us have said. And we need your voices to help make that a reality in Haiti, to bring Haiti in line in water and sanitation access for the rest of the hemisphere. And progress is being made in the immunization sector, and I'm sure that oral cholera vaccines and their use in Haiti will continue to be pushing the envelope for the rest of the world. So thank you all very much for coming to the session, and we hope you have a great conference.